research is the art of identifying problems, knowing which questions to ask of the available information. This is a red flag whenever something is presented as a black box that we cannot explain it, there's no transparency.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here, episode number 45. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well, Shaheen.
All right, perfect. Now, we have a very special guest today. So I'm going to start by saying that marketing is everything. As Regis McKenna said in his article in the Harvard Business Review many years ago, and it's completely still a valid article. If you haven't read it, go look it up. So as a result, because marketing is everything, it is really quite often hard for a marketing practitioner to describe ourselves in one word or one title, because we end up doing a lot of different things. So that's a great prelude to introducing our special guest, Mahta Imrani. You may have come across Mahta on Twitter, but if not, make sure you follow her there. Twitter handle is @MEMRANI. One thing you will notice is the depth and high quality of Mahta's observations, analysis, and also synthesis. So think of Mahta as a deep generalist. Her last formal title was VP of Consumer Insight, and that covers a good portion of it, but she has deep experience in market research in general. She spent several years at Kantar, a subsidiary of WPP, and these days she runs a consulting firm working with a collective of independent consultants at Metis Collective, that's METIS-collective.com, and also teaches part-time at the local university. Mahta also has a great knowledge of movies, if you ask me. So welcome, Mahta.
Thank you for having me, Doug and Shaheen. This is really fun and exciting. I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for that nice introduction.
Well, I'm chuckling about the introduction that the local university is simply University of Southern California's Annenberg School.
That's right. So USC, one of the finest institutions on the planet, and downtown LA, beautiful campus, and a collection of really nicely branded departments like Annenberg, where you have a degree from.
Annenberg, and also my undergrad was from their business school, Marshall.
So. Marshall, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so you're a Trojan, and fight on.
Yeah, fight on.
All right, we should actually talk about that as a marketing slogan at some point. But let's get to our cartoon of the week. There is something in the cart. Doug, would you want to set us up?
Absolutely. So just to set up the image that goes with the cartoon, we have three gentlemen. Look like they're from some big industrial firm back east. The cartoon actually looks a little bit like it's from the 80s, because the ties and the styles of jackets. And we have clearly the bald guy, who must be the CEO or chairman, the guy who's slightly less bald, who has a serious look on his face, and then the guy with the full head of hair with the most interesting tie. And he's presenting to them and has a bottle in front of him, and he says, well, our scientists say it would be a public health hazard, but market research shows it would sell like hotcakes. What do you think? There you go.
Doug, you go first. What does that cartoon make you think of?
My first reaction was to tie it into all the AI stuff that we're around right now, which, you know, companies always face these ethical dilemmas about something that seems like the market would buy it well, but they also know there's some risk of, let's call it some toxic side effects like this. And marketers are always known for, you know, we will think about these extremes of what would you do if a product had all this. I think the classic question for agencies was always, oh, would you advertise for somebody that sells tobacco?
Yeah.
You know, it was always one of those things. And then all I could think is, oh Lord, now imagine how bad it's gotten when you throw AI into the equation. And exactly. I think it just confuses the whole issue incredibly, because AI does not have ethics itself. You know, nothing about AI has ethics.
So ethics is really where my mind went, and integrity and ethics, and like, how badly do you want to participate in the demise of humanity to make a quick buck? And I think certainly AI has those sorts of overtones as well as just not being quite ready for prime time anyway. But Matha, in our pre-call, I think you had the great insight of associating this with research. So take it away.
Yeah, so my observation was that market research says, and there are so many examples of companies where they did research, they went out, they asked people, do you want this? Is this, will you use this? Will you buy this? And they're like, yes, why not? For sure, that sounds good. But then in reality, in practice, when you introduce it in the market, it's a failure. And that's because you're asking the wrong question. So that's what caught my attention in terms of like highlighting that it's the market research that's saying it will sell like hotcakes. Because market research, if you're asking the wrong question, you get the wrong answer and you cannot make decisions based on that. And an example that I shared, which was not AI, but I think it's a good example. There's a company that was a shoe company. They did a lot of research and looked at trends. They picked up on this fact that people want personalization. They want customized products. They want to design their own shoes. And then they did a lot of research and the research supported their hypothesis that yes, people do want their own shoes. They want to design something that's representative of them and their individuality on that. So they built a business around it and it failed. It failed because of many reasons. One, it's impractical because the supply chain cannot support something that's changing every single order. So it was impossible on that sense. But it also put a burden on the customers because even though they conceptually, yes, I love to be able to design my own stuff, but we're not shoe designers. And it's really hard to make a decision. What color should it be? What material should it be? What other unique designs should it have on it? You know, and you're overwhelming people with these choices and they're stuck with it because once you design it, it's not like you can return it because it's very specific to you. So from a business design standpoint, it was a failure. It was supported by market research, but market research was asking the wrong questions and the people deciding based on that were also not thinking about it because there is a whole lot more that goes into it than just what the customer says they want.
Yeah, this is great. Both of you guys have done a lot of research and surveys and focus groups. And so this is going to be a great topic for us. Plus AI, how can we skip that? So let's drill down into that. Now, this reminds me of an article that came about that actually, Matha, you posted on Twitter that I first noticed. And then I actually read the article. And it was about how AI could aid with research. So let's combine the two topics. On the face of it, it looked to me to be too good to be true. Like maybe AI is good for a demo. It's not quite ready for prime time for everything. For some things it is. And you guys understand the complexity of research like few people do. Let's have a chat about that.
Well, first of all, let me jump in and kind of explain the article. So the article came out of Marketing Week, dated the 13th of June this year, 2024. And it's written by Mark Ritson, who has quite a following. He has a mini MBA course he teaches that's highly popular around the world. He's got a lot of weight to throw behind something. And he threw all his weight behind this article, which he admits that he has a small investment in the company that he talks about. And the company is talked about is called Evidenza. And the idea is that they create synthetic customers or synthetic data from AI. And that now B2B customers can do all that they need in research through this Evidenza software. And that these synthetic customers are just as accurate and useful as any other research. And it leaves behind this sense of predicting that everything is going to go this way. Kind of a, you know, good salesmanship, but it's worth doing some real serious discussion here because it enters into a really difficult land of AI.
Yes, it's interesting because this concept of synthetic data is very hot topic right now in the research world. A lot of debates around it, for and against it. And interestingly enough, there are some people who are viewed and well-respected in the research arena as well, who advocate for it. And then there's also a smaller voice of opposition that's saying that we should be more careful and ask more questions. So there is a big topic of debate. And it's interesting that this article from Marketing Week came out like while this whole conversation is going on in the research world. And what caught my attention about the article specifically was, first of all, the people who are talked about and writing it are not necessarily coming from the world of research. So that was one interesting point. But also with the article itself, some of the statements made me scratch my head. For instance, it makes an argument about past research not being good. It's saying that research is problematic. So we established that there are issues with it because sample is not good, it's hard, it's expensive, it takes time. So it makes a case against traditional research. But then it says this is really good because it's 95% correlation with the past research that we just said that, you know, it's not good research. So it's 95% correlated with it. So why is that a good thing? And then it says the 5% that it's not, it's because the original data set is problematic. So then the question becomes, then what are we looking at? Are we looking at cheaper, faster of bad data? And is that because we're accepting that research is anyway going to give you bad results, so might as well get it faster and cheaper with this type of design? So that's the question. I think there may be something in there, but the way the information is shared, it's incomplete. We cannot accept it on face value. There is more question in terms of like, where is the data coming from? Like, how does it work? Like, what were the questions that were used to ask? You know, these are all valid questions, but we can't ask them. The answers are not there and it feels like a black box. And for me, this is a red flag whenever something is presented as a black box that we cannot explain it. There's no transparency, there's no true understanding of how it works. Because we've seen what it did to the marketing world with the whole, you know, programmatic and automation and all of those things. And now we have all these problems that we're now facing. And ironically, now everybody's going back and reading the books from the 70s about marketing science and all that, because they're going back, they're realizing that was important. So I feel like this is going to happen with research as well. Right now, everybody's excited about using AI automation. This world democratization of research makes me really scared, because it's giving research in the hands of people who don't really understand it, and then it's not going to have a good outcome. So this whole idea is going to push research into a certain area, and then within a few years, everybody's going to realize it was a mistake, and then they're going to go back, and then they're going to see, like, what is the best way to design a right survey or ask the right question? Because it's true that there's a lot of bad research out there. That's an absolutely accurate statement. A lot of the people who are practicing research are not truly trained on it. They don't really know how to ask the questions. They don't know how to ensure data quality. So there is a lot of issues with that. And that's absolutely a valid point. But the solution to that is to go back and understand why those problems exist and correct those. It's not to mask it by putting it through some sort of a, you know, black box and then automating it and scaling it so that now it's harder to see what the problem is. Because where is AI getting its data? It's from past research, and we established that there's a problem with that. So that's where my concerns are coming from. And given everybody's so enthusiastic about jumping on this bandwagon, it's scary because we don't have enough people saying, let's stop and think. Because Doug, you talked about the unintended negative consequences of technology, and we know it exists. So
yeah, our scientists say it would be a public health hazard, but you know, anyway, but it sells well. Well, it's funny, it's actually, as you were talking, I had this flashing bit of insight that didn't SurveyMonkey already take us through this, where the availability of cheap, easy ways to do research online, all of a sudden I found amongst my clients, every client thought they could just go do research for almost no cost with SurveyMonkey, and that was just fine. And of course, I'd read the research and the wrong questions were asked. There was no subtlety of trying to understand how people would hear those questions. There was very little, you know, because that's all stuff that as a researcher, you learn to take great care with all those things, because that's what, you know, at the end of the day, you want research, you can say, can I trust this to make a $5 or $10 or $100 million decision? That's the problem, you know? Can I trust what I found in order to make a big decision? And yet, you know, SurveyMonkey was Yahoo, let's turn everybody loose. Now you're just doing that through AI, and I have skepticism. We'll put it that way.
So I have multiple questions for you guys, but I want to make a comment about synthetic data. So synthetic data is not new. In the world of science and engineering, there is a scientific modeling that people do So when you design an airplane, there is a wind tunnel that you put the wing through. There's a big one at USC, in fact, a very nice wing tunnel, or, you know, the rocket lab and that sort of a thing. So within those, you try to come up with a scientific model that describes reality, not just mimic it, but describes it. And then you use those equations. Car companies do it with simulation of car crashes, and those simulations are pretty accurate at this point. They require supercomputers to run. It's a really heavy-duty simulation of things. So a physics-based, so to say, realistic, that's one way to get synthetic data. The other way you get synthetic data by looking at permutations of variables that are so numerous that you cannot do yourself, but a computer can. And that's how chess-playing machines can win, because they look at, you know, many more permutations that you can. When you try to apply those to a digital twin of an actual CIO or a B2B senior executive, that's the magic. And on the face of it, that's not so easy to do. So it's too far out. Even though you want to believe that eventually AI will do all of these things, it's just not doing it right now. So it becomes a little bit more difficult to believe.
You know, in a sense, if what this is doing is creating a sample of 300 customers, or, you know, call it 1,000 potential customers, so that we have statistical reliability in our fake sample anyway, but 1,000 customers, is that what they're kind of trying to do, which is develop this sampling that maybe there's enough range in it that we can trust? I don't know.
The way it was described.
No, but I mean, how can you do it? Because their argument is that what they had in the past was faulty. So where are they getting this information? I think we just don't know where this information is coming from. And one of the examples was that they create this persona and you can ask it questions and it would give you answers. But that's like a chat bot that you can ask it question and it comes up with stuff. But can you trust it? I mean, if it's a small language model, it's a controlled design where they actually trained it and they handpicked the input data and all that, possible. But then we're talking about information that you already knew. And like you said, Shine, it's almost like looking at different combinations and possibilities. How useful is that? There's so many question marks. One went into the training of it. What do you expect to get out of it? And then more importantly, how do you then account for things that have not happened in the past, like new scenarios, you know, uncertain things that didn't happen before, the unknown? You cannot get that. And that's where the value of research, in my view, lies. Yes, there are different types of research, some that you use to measure and size things. You use ones to validate and test things. But there is also research where you need to understand and pick up on the outliers and then see something and, you know, look at the relationships. But you cannot do that if all you're looking at is something that's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. If your entire knowledge is historical and something changed that is causing you to actually want to do this research, then your only shot is that you can permute things, but then those don't quite seem to need this kind of a digital avatar. And Doug, something I learned from you many years ago was just how difficult it is to formulate even the questions that you're asking.
That's the odd thing in all the discussion about research. And I mean, I made my crack about SurveyMonkey, but it's true that you have to, you know, survey design is a phase of the research project. And survey has to be well designed, which means you're talking to the right people, you're asking them the right questions, and you're asking questions to enlighten your decision. You're not asking them to answer your decision. And I don't know how many CEOs I've been around, they'll say, well, let's just go ask them if they'll buy this. And the answer is you can't do that. If you ask, you're going to get, you get bullshit back if that's what you ask them. So what you have to do is ask other questions to sort it out, and then make human judgment calls about what you think it means. It's a much more subtle process. The other thing I was thinking about introducing here as a way to maybe talk about some of this is my good friend Carla Roberts, who was a focus group moderator I worked with for, I won't tell how many years, but a long time. But Carla and I have done tons of research together, but she also did a lot of this B2B research, especially in medical. So she would do focus groups where they'd bring in 6 to 8 doctors, pay them $500. This was 15 years ago, and then talk in depth about issues they had and about products that might respond to them, and just to understand the real interactive part of this. And in a way, if I think about her doing that, there's no evidence that this kind of evidenza stuff would ever supply the insights that you could get from sitting and talking with doctors about your medical product.
If you have bad research, there's a lot of, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of bad research out there. So there are, you can have moderators that are not as skilled as the person you work with, and they can get surface answers. They don't dig deep. They don't get at the heart of the issue. And yet the client still pays the $500 incentive, and it still takes the same amount of time. But the information that they get out of it, maybe stuff that they already knew, or things that they could have guessed without having to spend that much time and wait that long. So for someone who's had that experience, if you present them with this concept, they would like it because this is their pain point. And they're like, yes, I get it. Why would I pay? This is useful for me. I like it. But it goes back to what I was saying. I think the problem is still unsolved. We need to fix why there is bad research. We need to fix that, not to automate it and scale it and then hide it, you know, in a black box. That's my concern. And the main audience of this is these people who've had these negative experiences with research. Like I always tell my students that research is the least sexy, interesting part of their curriculum. They have to take it because it's mandatory, but my job is for them to understand, fall in love with it because they can see the value of it and they can see that it's not just about writing a survey. It's not just about running a focus group. It's much, much more than that. And there's an art that goes into it. Like the way you ask the question, you can get completely different outcomes and learnings depending on how you approach it. And I think we need more of that. We need to teach people that as opposed to, like, there's a lot of bad research out there, so let's skip it. But because we want to make our decisions based on data, we still need that. But so let's use AI. Because one thing that I kept repeating in the article was that the AI is better and more accurate. I'm like, how is that? That doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't understand it. Maybe there's not enough information in there for me to make that connection. But why would AI be more accurate than getting data from real people, you know?
Actually, if you think about the AI, that, you know, the AI has arrived from scrubbing something, whether it's scrubbing the internet or scrubbing surveys that big survey firms have done, or, you know, maybe Simmons is all fed into it or something. But it's all done based on assumptions. So every data that comes in has weakness. And what's interesting is the article says nothing about the data's weaknesses. So it's not inherently more accurate. Maybe it's more accurate sometimes and less accurate other times. That's probably their best case, right? Because nothing is fully accurate all the time.
I think the implication in the article was that B2B research, which is where they're targeting, and I did like their positioning. I think their positioning around synthetic data and targeting at B2B is sort of exactly what they need to do right now. That was really well done. But I think the implication was that in the B2B world, you actually can have a more honest relationship with the digital twin than with the actual physical twin, that you're not going to get on the calendar of some senior exec. When you do, they're not going to tell you everything, you know, unvarnished, whereas their digital avatar is just going to like spill the beans and tell you the reality.
But where are those beans coming from?
Correct.
No. I'm having a hard time feeling like if they're unwilling to spill the beans, how the digital avatar figure it out? You know, I mean, there's nothing that indicates a digital avatar is going to know what the beans are to be spilled.
Yeah. So I want to talk about B2B research. If we can put a circle around B2B and some of the nuances, let's talk about that. Matt, what you were saying?
No, I was just going to say, like, Doug's example was healthcare. That's really nuanced. The examples they used, I think they probably talking to in the article, maybe the examples they've used for their case studies are more generic things, like such as, you know, hiring needs or, you know, how much they should spend on XYZ resources and things like that, because I think it came from one of their data sets that they referenced from Ernst & Young. So maybe in those cases, because it's not, the world is not going to change like drastically, you know, so maybe you can rely on past data for these types of things. But if it's something more nuanced, if it's something that like healthcare, where you also have privacy issues, you cannot put that into some sort of a machine, you know. So, or if you're making a really high risk decision, would you rely? I want to ask like a business business owner, if you're making a really high risk decision, do you feel comfortable making it based on like saving money because you don't want to spend it and you don't want to wait, but you want to make a multi-million dollar, so you want to rely on an AI, you know, generated data? I want to ask if that's realistic. If you're doing just like a health, like brand health thing once a year, nobody's going to lose their job, like if it's like a few points up and down or something like that, and you don't expect major changes. Maybe it's possible, like Doug said, maybe you're supplementing it from scraping the social media conversations, all of those things. Some of these companies are already doing. Like you can look at conversations around brands and you can quantify that and then use it as a health check to see where your brand stands on certain things. So that, sure. But if you're actually making those big decisions that require the investment behind it, I think you still have to go out and get good research and wait for it. You cannot expect it to, you know, give you the answer the next day. So
do we get to apply the fast, quick, and easy? You get two,
yeah,
or three,
you cannot do fast, all you quick. Cannot do all three. Yeah. And this is interesting because I feel like this is a trap that market research created for themselves, because no client ever expected to get good stuff fast and cheap. This is a narrative that researchers themselves started to compete with each other. So the company was like, we should do it cheaper than our competition. And then they're like, well, we need, you know, it needs to be higher qualities from the competition. So we have to come up with some proprietary model or framework or something like that. They have, like we have, they don't have. So you when you look at these market research, big market research company, everybody has their own model, like brand love, you know, brand this, brand blah, blah, blah. But why do they have these things? It's because they want to show they have that quality. And then they want to do it fast. So they train the client, their customers to expect that. Now they're in this situation where instead of like focusing on how to do better research, they're trying to like, within hours, I'll give you the answer, you know, I'll do it cheaper. But I think it's a slippery slope. And like I said, it's like the same, I feel like it's on the same trajectory that programmatic marketing went. And I feel like it's going to backfire. And there's a lot of money, like there's a lot of investment going on into research technology. So there is appetite for it. It's a field that deals with data. There's a lot of tech firms that have figured to do certain things, and they see this is a, you know, ripe target for them to go and market their products and try to sell it. If you look at a lot of these companies in the research tech, they're not researchers that came up with this solution. It's a technology firm that had something, and then they're trying to repurpose it, and they have to create the need. So they need narratives out there so that there is a need, here's our solution, you need it. Otherwise, you're going to fall behind. So I feel there's a little bit of that going on.
I was going to say, Monte, because I went back and looked at where these guys are from that founded it. And they ran the called now legendary, which I stay off of LinkedIn, so it's not legendary to me, but the B2B Marketing Institute at LinkedIn. Wait a minute, that has nothing to do with research. That doesn't show they have deep foundation in what research is. I tend to agree with you that there's always danger that these things are created by people who find an investment opportunity to pay out for them and know that there's a market there as opposed to a really good idea. There's always risk of that. The other thought I think is missing as a rather large omission from the article is, wait a minute, doesn't AI have a hallucination problem? I mean, AI is well known to hallucinate legal cases that don't exist. So I look at this, I'm like, wow, as a guy who then goes, wait, okay, so you promise this, but where's the discussion of hallucination? Because that invalidates it all to some degree. If I can't know as trustworthy, if I can't say, okay, I believe this is fully trustworthy, and I know they provided an example where it 95% agrees with bad research. So, I don't know.
So I want to pose something to you guys. And while we were talking in our pre-call, I got to notion of like, what is research? And research is really knowledge, knowing stuff, right? And because it's knowledge, it can lead into a whole lot of different kinds of knowledge because it's all over the place. Do you think what's going on here is a confusion between data and knowledge?
Yes, I think you're right. I have to qualify this, that this could be my own bias, because I believe to be a good researcher, you have to be multidisciplinary and you have to have a wider perspective and you have to expose yourself to different things, which is partly why I'm a generalist. It's by design. It's on purpose, because if you become too focused on one area, then you miss the big picture and you don't see it. So going back to this, yes, there is a confusion between data and research. Data is just data. It's raw, random information. Research is the art of identifying problems, knowing which questions to ask of the available information, knowing which data sets or which data sources to look at, being able to connect them. So that's where the value of the research is. But to get there, you need the data to be reliable and viable. You need something that is coming from a correct source. So you need to know who to ask, and then you also need to know how to ask it. But that's just the beginning part, because that then gives you information, pulling what that means and making sense out of it, and the quote-unquote insight, which not always you have it, but that's the other part of it. You can argue, which a lot of researchers are doing. They're saying that because market research is in such a volatile space, a lot of experienced researchers are not putting themselves at the other end of it. They're saying, like, we're not dealing with the data collection. We're just here to make sense out of the data. But the danger is that if the data is faulty, it doesn't matter how great of a thinker you are, you're working with flawed information. Which, again, I keep going back to this point that we need to fix the source of the problem, not try to add, unmask it and do, you know, backflips and things like that.
I think that's a huge point, that a large body of inaccurate data doesn't magically make it accurate.
Yes.
It's still inaccurate.
No, there's a lot of tech that tries to promise that if we just get enough customers, we're magically going to have profit.
Yeah.
You know, if we just get enough data, it'll magically turn out to be something.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen.
Larger data set, more data doesn't necessarily mean better learning. It could actually be the opposite of it. The bigger it gets, the more noise there is, the more false relationships you may find, because you will find relationships, but they're not real ones. And that's a problem. Now, there are data scientists and things like that who can speak to this with greater depth and accuracy. But even for someone like me, who's not a data scientist, it's like if you just stand back and look at it and think about it, these are the types of questions that will come to mind. What are these relationships? Like the 95% correlation that we keep talking about. Did anybody pay attention to the article? It's saying all the data is bad, but we like this. This is accurate because 95% correlated to that bad data. I'm like,
what are you talking about? You know, you've heard me talk about the data supply chain and a data product, that data really is just the raw material that you can get from anywhere. And the raw material could be interesting, could not be interesting, but if you want to filter it, add to it, synthesize it, et cetera, before it becomes a nugget of insight that is worth the money and all of that. So in this case, synthetic data is just another source of data. So I think part of the fallacy of this is to call it research rather than call it another source of data that may or may not be good.
I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, I think you're right. The problem is not AI and the problem is not synthetic data. The problem is the narrative that, this is going to replace. Yeah, and it's enough.
That's the problem. Yeah.
I suppose sometime we need to spend another episode on, okay, so what is that up front that we all need to work on? And what have been the problems? I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I've noticed is a lot of companies end up with bad research because they pick the research companies according to how they would evaluate every other vendor, which is how long have they been in business? Do other respectable people use them? And, you know, all these kinds of things, not with any sense of...
Oh, I can tell you some horror stories. So what happened is like, and I don't want to say everybody, but it happens a lot. So a client comes and you put your star performers in front of that client, right? But usually they're the business development people. They know some research, but they're not the ones in the trenches doing the work, right? So you put them in front of the client, they're doing the client relationship, and then they clients like, I want this, I want that, and this, and they're like, yes, we can do it. And look at me, look at all my credentials. And the client's like, yes, okay, I'll give you $1 million and you do this research for me. And then that business development person comes back and then they hand it over to a team of researchers. And that team of researchers looks at the things that have been promised and they're like, no, we cannot do this and we cannot do that. And they're like, no, make it work, you know, make it work. And then the client, when they pay these $1 million accounts, they expect a large team. So you sent them then this file where it has like 20 people, all different levels of expertise they're working on it. Whereas in reality, you have like, maybe if you're lucky, 5 people and they're pulling their hair out because they're trying to do something. And then you end up with, at the end of it, if the client is smart, after a while, they see like, okay, this data, something doesn't quite add up. And then you get the reputation that research is bad.
Well, and actually, it's made worse because sometimes I've seen the research reports padded out where half the pages are boilerplate. So yet half the pages are unique and interesting and apply to me, and half is just boilerplate from other work that's been done. But, you know, we still evaluate research reports by how far down the stairs they go when you throw them.
And, and I don't want to... When I say the business development people behave a certain way, the clients also bear some of the responsibility because they are trying to serve them. So it's also the client also has to recognize that they play a part into this. When they ask for things that it's not realistic, you know what I mean? And sometimes they resist, like brand tracking, which is something that actually Mark Ritson really likes and talks about. And he's also invested in the new company that does it. Brand tracking is a very valuable and powerful research tool, but it's also the most very difficult and complicated and expensive because for it to work, you need to have consistency over time, which is very hard to do. And usually on the client side, let's say like if you're working with the marketing person from the brand side, they just want, because they also don't view research as a strategic tool, they also see it just as some numbers, give me these numbers so I can show my boss that what we did worked. So they're also not open sometimes. Those clients are not open to having those conversations with the researcher. So if the researcher comes and tries to act like a consultant, be strategic and say, maybe we should look at this. We saw an anomaly in the data. Like there's some weird trend they're like, don't tell me all of those things. Just here's the scorecard. Just update that. You know what I mean? So there's like multiple stakeholders that are at play that collectively are fueling this revolution against research, you know, which is unfortunate.
I fully agree with that. And I think, you know, I've found it's tricky because the nuances of research are hard sometimes to communicate back into the client world, not often in marketing, but they always have to report back into everybody else. And once you step beyond the marketing department, everybody else is like, no, wait, isn't this a simple answer? You know, give me the simple answers. You know, you're making it too complicated. No, we're trying to make it accurate and trustworthy and something we can invest $100 million based on.
And nobody likes when somebody asks too many questions or maybe says, like, gives you a finding that maybe it wasn't what you expected, you know, and research could be that, and not everybody is brave.
So some of what you guys are saying goes back to what Mato, you were saying. Why are you doing research at all? Are you doing it to gain insight and learn something about reality, in which case you have to be in touch with reality? And as Richard Feynman said, nature cannot be fooled. Or are you trying to validate something that you did and you're just creating a dossier to support it, in which case you're not really in touch with reality? So that really is an unfortunate real situation, isn't it?
And I think, too, a lot of companies confuse those two, and they'll use the same researchers that they've used for just tracking or validating what they've done. They'll use those same researchers to do exploration and discovery. And as I tell people, look, when you're doing exploration and discovery, the point is either to find out how to spend the money to make far more profit, or whether you should choose not to spend the money and save it. You're kind of down at those fundamentals, but it's different from the fundamentals of somebody who's used to doing tracking research. Or, you know, they're different beasts, and companies a lot of companies struggle to see that difference.
So let me go through some notes I took. We said data is not knowledge. We said research is knowledge. So don't position data as research. We said knowledge comes in many different ways and flavors. We should do research with the intent of learning about reality and gaining actual knowledge. We need transparency. We need to craft the questions right. We need to not get confirmation bias. Matthew, you sort of even pointed out, I may be projecting my own bias here, which shows that you're really alert to that.
Yes,
we need to be alert to that. And we need to ultimately recognize the difference. And what else would you add to that?
If I could, let me throw an idea your way, Mata. I'd love your thoughts on it. It seems like, in a way, great research has to be like great writing, which is great writing, detail matters. I think Ray Bradbury said that. It's like detail is what brings writing alive. And I think for me, that's one of the things I look for in reviewing research to see whether I believe that it got to things. Did it get the nuances, the details? Did it discover something that surprises me, those details? I don't know. That's my way of saying. What would you say, Martha?
Yeah, and on that note, that's why I don't think good research, like good exploratory research with the intent to truly understand, can be rushed. Because if you rush it, you're either jumping to conclusion, relying on your biases, pre-assumptions, or from a more technical standpoint, you're using pre-existing things. You're using templates, you know, you're using standardized approach where, as opposed to, you know, like a very specific, situation-specific research design and all of those things. So if, like Shaheen, you said, if the goal is just validation and measuring, sure, you can do it maybe faster and whatever. But if it's truly understanding and discovery and exploration, like Doug said, that has to be slow and deliberate and thoughtful. It cannot be rushed. And that's the value. The value is in that. You know what I mean? That's why it can also not be cheap. So if a client, if you're, like I said earlier, if a client is making a $1 billion decision and expects an answer tomorrow, that there's something wrong with that. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you're saying it's even not advisable. It's bad for business to rush. Insights that is influencing a very big decision. And also, Doug, you mentioned nuance. And I remember in the old days, we used to say the difference between a novice and an expert is a nuance. It's all the jaggedy edges that they know about, not the core that is simple to understand and Google these days, right?
Yeah, in those nuances, you see it when you read people's survey questions. I had a lot of clients that would send me research and I would review it and I'd be like, you guys shouldn't rely on this. Because you could tell in the detail, the most common error, which we shouldn't even be seeing these days, is for clients, manufacturers, companies, to use their internal language in customer-facing research.
Yeah,
oh my God, I can't tell you how many times I've seen that where, you know, well, we describe these customers according to these categories. And so we use those categories in the research. Are you a, and like, you know, like you can't do that. It's just, it's all wrong. All wrong.
So let's start to conclude our episode. Any parting comments, Doug?
Well, I'm going to do something. We'll see if this works. There's an old research joke. And my question is, how does this new AI idea fit with it? And the research joke is that a company invents a product, market researchers take it out, they work with customers, they come back and they say, this product's shit. You know, what are you doing? And the engineers are like, oh, okay, well, we'll talk to our management about it, but they can't use that word with their management. So they go to their management and say, it's manure, you know, it's manure. So as it goes up the chain, what the CEO tells the board is that the product's going to make the company grow. Right? And I think it's always a worthwhile joke because it happens so often, you know, whether it's, you know, CEOs going through verbatim statements for focus group and picking the one comment they like and saying they're going to base their entire future strategy on it. While we're down here going, no, that guy was stupid. He was crazy. He was insane. You know, don't do it. But wherever it is that it happens where, you know, corporate politics play their own role. And somehow there's something here about what's going on with Evidenza and that joke. I don't know what it is. So maybe you can enlighten me.
We'll find out in 2 years.
We will.
But I also have a joke, but I'm not as good as Doug and saying jokes, but basically it's from Market Tunis, and it's about market research as well. And it shows, and you may have seen it, but it shows like three individuals who are in, like, one is in a walker, the other one's in a wheelchair, and the other one is standing with a cane, and they're standing in front of a board with all different kinds of research like listed, and they've crossed them out, and they're like, oh, we're finally ready to go to market. So this is like against the slow research, but it's saying like they've done so much, they had done so much research that by the time they're done, they're like old, not too old. So I say defend the slow research, but it has to also be within reason, obviously.
Right.
I think in a sense, I think that's a great way to put it, because in a sense, what we have to do is make the really smart investments in research. It doesn't mean just go dump money right and left. I once worked with Procter & Gamble over 30 years ago, and they came into us with a product and they said, oh yeah, our research budget's 500 grand. We always spend 500 grand before we even think about taking it to market. And we went out and spent about 30,000 and came back with a whole bunch of enlightenment that they hadn't captured through that, 500,000. Not that they'd done the wrong things. They had a process they had to do, but there's the equal dangers of analysis paralysis or the cowboy, yee-haw, let's just go take this to market. We don't care whether we do it right, whether we do it well, or whether anybody cares.
Yeah, and I think also to reiterate what Shahin, you were also saying, that we're not saying AI is bad and we're not saying synthetic data has zero value. We're just saying that value should not be overstated. And it, like you said, it's possible, depending on what it is and understanding it, it could be a good addition to the suite of data sets that one looks at in order to understand and make it.
Absolutely. I see it as another source of data, but it's another source of data that's not coming from an actual real human being. So right there, it's suspect, but it might have value. So let's go filter it, massage it, plug it into the data supply chain, but it's not the final product.
Well, also, it wasn't gathered with your specific question in mind,
exactly.
Which means it is secondary data inherently, right? And that, that there's a difference between primary and secondary in that one.
Well, it didn't learn with your specific, but it is answering your specific question, albeit based on...
That's what we do with secondary data all the time, which is we take our questions against it. And I reintroduce it, because I did see, I think Bruce Clark mentioned it. I don't know, Monte, you might have seen that, but Bruce Clark, who I've all mentioned this, about how data is primarily secondary. It's all from the past and not gathered because my company needs to make this decision today. And it's not that it's bad. That's just fine. It just has more cautions with it than research, data from research we designed, knowing, well, we have to make this decision. So therefore, we have to ask these
things. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Doug, as usual. Thank you, Mata.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Mata. Thank you.
What a treat to have you, to finally have a good, high-quality chat, not just on Twitter.
It was a fun topic, and I don't think it ends. It's an ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
It really is. So, Doug, thank you for posing that cartoon that led to all of this discussion that we had.
Yeah.
And thankfully, we had Mata here that is exactly the kind of expert that can comment on this.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you all for listening. See you on social media and elsewhere.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.